Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm John Favreau.
I'm John Lovett.
I'm Tommy Vitor.
On today's show, Iran's retaliatory strike on Israel scrambles U.S. politics, and the New York Times is the latest poll to show some good news for Joe Biden. But first...
It's an assault on America, and that's why I'm very proud to be here. This is an assault on our country.
Jury selection in the People of the State of New York versus Donald J. Trump has officially begun, though after one day, not a single juror has been picked. None of them made it past the first day. The Republican nominee is the first former president to stand trial for criminal charges. He has pleaded not guilty to 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to conceal violations of state and federal election laws. In this case, the alleged violation involves a hush money payment that Trump made in the weeks before the 2016 election to keep voters from finding out about his affair with porn star Stormy Daniels. Since we have no law degrees and one decent LSAT score between the three of us, Strict Scrutiny's Melissa Murray is going to talk to Tommy a bit later about the strength of District Attorney Alvin Bragg's case. But since Trump will be the first presidential nominee to spend the first 2 months of the general election in a courtroom, nearly a quarter of the entire race.
2 months.
Between now and November, he could end up spending
could it, be
just on this
just
trial.
Could be longer. Right?
Yeah. So yeah, we're going to dig into the politics. Let's start big picture. Most people aren't familiar with the details of this case, let alone that it's happening, beyond something about Trump paying hush money to a porn star. If an undecided voter asked you guys why this should matter in the context of this election, what would you say? Lovett, you want to go first?
I was thinking about that question. And first of all, I do think sometimes you don't need to say more than he paid hush money to a porn star to hide it from voters.
You would hope.
But I do think if you did feel the need to add on to that, you can say that, you know, he had his goons cook the books and commit fraud to hide the payments. His own lawyer went to federal prison for helping to commit the fraud. I think that, like, most people view it as unethical and illegal. But you can also say he did it for the same reasons he cut his own taxes when he was president, why he spends all day reading about himself on the internet, why he tried to overturn the election in 2024. He is only thinking about himself. And that is even worse now with all these criminal cases. He is thinking about himself day in and day out. He is doing what is good for him. He is not doing what is good for the country. He is always looking for an angle. And he believes that there should be one set of rules for him and his rich friends and one set of rules for everybody else.
Tommy, you got anything to add?
No, I think it's good. I mean, I would just say, like, you guys, you undecided voter, you deserve to know all the relevant facts about a candidate before you vote. And in this case, Donald Trump denied you that knowledge by illegally coordinating with a news organization to keep news out of the press. And he thought that information was important. We know that because he paid $130,000 to suppress it. And we know because he is constantly bitching about social media sites suppressing information about Hunter Biden, who last time I checked never ran for president in the 2020 race. So Trump broke campaign finance laws to deny you access to information you deserved. And we can't let candidates do that because our political system is already a mess and money is awash through it and distorting it in bad ways. And now it'll become even more broken.
Yeah, he's a liar and a cheater. Cheated in 2016, cheated in 2020, trying to cheat again in 2024.
Cheated on Melania.
Hey, voter, if you had an affair with a porn star and you were running for office, would you be able to cover it up? Would you be able to pay a bunch of people to bury stories, including a major media outlet like the National Enquirer? The whole scheme. He's got the National Enquirer helping him out. He's paying things. He's gotten shell companies. It's like, it is, though. It's one set of rules for him, one set of rules for everyone else, and all he cares about is himself.
Yeah, we all have somebody in our life. They're always surrounded by chaos. They're always dealing with their own bullshit. They're always blaming everyone else but themselves. They're always saying, like, oh, if I could just, once I solve this, oh, then everything's going to be smooth sailing for me. You have somebody in your life like that, and they're entertaining. Sometimes they're at the table, and you realize you are that person. but you don't try. But you know what I mean? That person who's
gotta
like,
get a gag order.
Their life's always a mess, and they always blame everybody else. They may be fun for a while, but you don't ask them to walk your dog. You don't ask them to water the plants, you know? You leave them alone.
Don't give them the nuclear codes.
You don't give them the nuclear codes. You I got that don't. Right. That was my next thing. Nuclear weapons. And you also, don't give it to them.
And also, this fits within Trump's larger gestalt here, which is, could he have silenced her without breaking the law? Yeah, probably. There's nothing inherently illegal about a hush money payment, but because he's an idiot and a criminal.
I know. But I remember John Edwards went through this problem, which is that if you pay them through the campaign, It's an illegal use of campaign funds. If you don't pay them through the campaign, it's an in-kind contribution. Right. You can really get fucked by the fact that sometimes it's kind of the legality of paying off somebody you've slept with to keep it from the voters. It's a challenge.
It's a challenge.
And we've always said that.
Well, and part of what saved John Edwards was that, like, he
nothing saved John Edwards.
Well, but his argument, well, he didn't get convicted.
That's true.
But his argument was, I was trying to conceal it from my wife, not necessarily not the voters, my wife who was dying of cancer at the time. Donald Trump. I think that Alvin Bragg's going to have plenty of evidence that Donald Trump was not doing this to conceal it from Melania and Barron.
Yeah.
No.
But he was doing it to conceal it from the voters, which is why you have Karen McDougal, the Playboy model, who he also buried another story about an affair with the National Enquirer. And he had a whole operation.
Listen, a system.
Known as Catch and Kill.
It was known as Catch and Kill. And honestly, I put a gag order on me because I've thought about this a lot in my past. And these issues, all for the best.
What else you got, John?
Yeah. Anyway, let's talk about how Trump is handling this trial. So far, it seems like he could have used a few more Diet Cokes before Monday's hearing, based on reporting from Maggie Haberman. Let's listen.
40 minutes ago, you wrote an observation that I was very surprised. Trump appears to be sleeping. His head keeps dropping down and his mouth goes slack. Tell us about that.
Well, Jake, he appeared to be asleep, and, you know, repeatedly his head would fall down. There have been other moments in other trials, like the E.G. Carroll trial, which was around the corner in January, where he appeared very still and seemed as if he might be sleeping, but then he would move. This time, he didn't pay attention to a note that his lawyer, Todd Blanche, passed him. His jaw kept falling on his chest, and his mouth kept going slack. Now, sometimes people do fall asleep during court proceedings, but it's notable given the intensity of this morning and a lot of what was being argued.
Yeah, that's rather surprising.
I almost wanted to cut this clip right after Jake goes on this long. He's like, Maggie, you just reported that he looked like he was falling asleep. Well, yes, Jake, he was falling asleep.
I know. Maggie's so funny and matter-of-fact on TV.
I know. Apparently, this got back to Trump.
Yes.
During the trial, because then as he was walking out, another reporter said he was glaring at Maggie as he walked out.
Well, so one thing that Maggie Haberman pointed out in her live posting about this is that a Trump aide named Natalie Harp is in the courtroom, and she's apparently one of Trump's favorites because she has a wireless printer that she uses to print out good news to show him.
Oh, she's the one who like follows him on a golf cart and does it sometimes?
So, yeah, how do I hire one of those people?
What?
We got you covered.
I don't have to read Twitter anymore. Someone just gives me good tweets. Good tweets.
Listen, I think it'd be good for you. Maybe it stops using, if you don't have to use your phone at the urinal. There's somebody waiting outside the bathroom.
It's not getting crazy.
I want you guys to know that I asked Melissa Murray, at what point in the duration of a nap does it go from misdemeanor to felony? So nice. Stay tuned for that.
To cover up insomnia.
That's a good update.
All right. So he was a little sleepy during the trial, but before the trial, for weeks before the trial, we heard him talking about how this is an assault on America in that clip at the top. He's been ranting and raving on his fake Twitter. He's saying, quote, I want my voice back. Yes. Once again, just being silenced everywhere. Yeah, right.
Never hear from him.
Little Mermaid.
Yeah, that's the Little Mermaid. He's just like Ariel. He's calling this the Biden Manhattan witch hunt case, which is a little wordy.
That doesn't sing.
But I'm sure they're all calling it like the Biden case, the Biden trials. Sure. This is what the Trump campaign wants to do now because everything is, you know. The campaign's raising money off the trial, getting surrogates to talk about it, and they told Playbook that, quote, being stuck in Manhattan 4 days a week will not affect Trump's ability to communicate. No shit. So fair enough, but I guess the question is what he communicates. Playbook went on to write, quote, he can just as easily ignore the hush money case and stick to campaign messaging during his arrival and departures and lunch break, which is, I laughed at, but then I was like, yeah, for any normal campaign, that might be what the hell did the candidate do and what the candidate wants to do. Like, you're dealing with this legal stuff. Let's have you counter-program with something else. What do you guys think about him talking and posting nonstop about this trial for the next 6 to 8 weeks of the general? Do you think his campaign's okay with that? Or are they just resigned to that because it's Trump? Would he even be able to break through with other messages?
Yeah, I'm sort of trying to imagine. First of all, of course, they're resigned to it. What else are they going to fucking do? He was read literal rights. He has to stay there. They're going to send a fucking paddy wagon. I have to go find him. But
what the judge said to him.
But, you know, what is the version of this that's like, I don't know, the best they can hope for from Donald Trump is him angrily storming out of the courtroom being like, Biden's trying to throw me in jail. Meanwhile, the border, and then 2 minutes on the border, right? That's what they're going to hope they can get out of this.
Yeah. That's exactly right. I mean, yeah, you're in Manhattan, not rural Kansas. You know, I mean, you lose like the local touch from events. You lose the local news coverage. But yeah, I mean, I think if his staff could decide what he was going to talk about every single day and get him to stick to it, they would focus on immigration and the border, and they would demagogue crime and chaos. But Trump is a narcissist. No matter what, like even if he wasn't in a courtroom, he was going to be whining about himself and bitching and moaning about the deep state. And that's obviously broken through and resonated. But I, like you were saying earlier, it's most effective of it when he makes it about, I'm the one taking shots on your behalf from the deep state, from the liberals to, because next they're coming after you. If he makes it like a bigger message, and I don't know, we'll see if he can do that here.
Yeah. And the only times he's done that is either like when he's at a rally and he's got a prompter and they've written that line in, mm-hmm. you know, cause they're trying to work with what they got, the yep. campaign, the Trump campaign. Right. And so they're, okay, he's going to make this trial all about himself, all these charges about himself, but at least we can pivot to being like, oh, I'm doing it on behalf of all that kind of shit. And there is polling that shows that people believe these charges are politically motivated, even the same polls that say that they're serious charges yeah. and that Trump is probably guilty of a crime.
Honestly,
but
I
also
agree
that they're politically motivated.
Sign me up. I'm one of those people. Fuck yeah.
I don't think that's the case in any of the other trials. But like, the more he talks about himself and how he's a victim and a martyr and like, you know, America's Nelson Mandela, like I do think the more he risks losing people who aren't Trump fanatics. Yeah. Like, I just don't think you can spend 6 to 8 weeks talking about yourself and what a victim you are.
The flip side of that, the reason there is real political risk here is Trump does best when he is able to dominate the news coverage all day, every day, and just make himself the center of gravity the way he did in 2016, the way he's struggled to do that more recently. So I think to the extent there's a political risk to Joe Biden or anyone else is that like Donald Trump once again blots out the sun and he bets on this being a low turnout election for just the most intense partisans on both sides. And he thinks, well, me being the victim, fighting for you as the victim is what motivates my folks.
Yeah, I think they're in a little bit of still in the primary mode, though, Republican primary with this message, right? Where it's like they think that everyone loves him. He thinks everyone loves him. He's unbeatable in the primary, and grievance works with Republican primary voters. There is a version where he and the campaign are disciplined enough to constantly make this about these people are after me, but I'm in it for you. I do not think he's disciplined enough to do that. And I do think that the whine, you know, he was whining today after the trial about how he's not going to be able to go to Barron's graduation, which the judge has not ruled on yet. The judge said, I can't rule on that yet because it's not till May 17th. Whining that he can't go to the Supreme Court for oral arguments. Over his contention that being president lets you do any of the crimes you want.
Right.
So, like, I don't know that that's, like, if people, to the extent that people tune in, to the extent that people catch this, I don't know if that's going to really land with people.
Yeah, I mean, I do think Trump blotting out the sun certainly helped him become the nominee. I don't think it helped him become president as much. And if you look at, like, kind of blur your eyes, we're going to talk about the Times Siena poll, but, like, There's a way in which people vaguely remember Trump as a divisive figure, but they're losing touch with just how negative and awful he was, and only with rose-colored glasses remembering the economy before the pandemic. One of the numbers is that like 70% in the Times poll said that he'd said something that was offensive, but they were in the distant past. And I do think Trump out there every day just riffing is going to put the Trump they hate back in their minds, because people view Biden as a less divisive figure and a figure more capable of uniting the country. That's a good point for Joe Biden to have day in, day out.
On day one of the trial, the DA asked the judge to hold Trump in contempt for violating his gag order in at least 3 posts where he attacked witnesses like Michael Cohen. The DA wants a fine of only $1,000 per post. $1,000 per post.
In other words, it's a $1,000 post fee.
But he also did ask the judge to jail Trump if he does it again. The judge hasn't ruled on that yet. There's going to be a separate hearing on that, I believe, on April 24th. But Judge Merchan already threatened Trump with jail time if he disrupts the trial or if he doesn't show up. Do you guys think Trump has the discipline to shut the fuck up and follow the gag order? Or do you think he actually wants to be thrown in jail, as some people have suggested?
I don't believe that for a fucking second.
I'm with you.
Look, if you go back, I remember...
I think he wants people to think he's not afraid of being thrown in jail.
He definitely wants that. If you go back, I remember... During the 2016 campaign when Trump was being deposed, I believe because of the lawsuit around Jose Andres pulling the restaurant.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And from the hotel in D.C.
Man, we are stuck in 2016 forever.
We did something wrong in our previous playthrough, and now we're learning our lesson. But But if you watch those depositions, there's a control Trump has when he really needs to have it that we forget that Trump does. I think that one of his great tricks is convincing people he doesn't respond to incentives. He does. I think what he is counting on is that he gets a certain number of very clear warnings before the last warning, before he gets thrown in jail. Mm-hmm. And I think that is when he will suddenly discover he knows how to shut the fuck up. That would be my prediction.
Yeah, historically speaking, he has been disciplined during depositions. He can pull it together when he has to. I also think there's a lot of reporting, Maggie Haberman's reported on this, that he's really scared of jail. And he really doesn't want to go to jail, understandably, by the way.
I think he'd do well.
But look, I'll argue the other side of it, because why not? I mean, you could imagine the scenario where the ultimate example of the system being rigged and unfair is Donald Trump getting thrown into jail for speech made in the context of a presidential campaign. And that's a very high stakes gamble. The outcome would really suck for him. But, you know, you could see someone arguing for it.
Well, and that goes to sort of Lovett's point, I think, where it's the raptor testing the fences kind of thing, right? Where he's going right up to them, because if he does end up getting thrown in jail for one that's not as clear cut threat to the life of a witness or something like that, you're sort of like, should he have been thrown in jail? Then the debate becomes that specific tweet, should that have landed him in jail? Is that fair? And that becomes a...
Imagine being the consultant pitching this idea in the room with Donald Trump. All right. No bad ideas in a brainstorm. What if you went to jail?
I also can I put on my tinfoil hat for a second?
Mm-hmm. Please.
I do think... So a Trump... over the weekend, there was sort of a Trump statement about their kind of goals and expectations for this trial, and it was that they don't think that they can hope for
goal not guilty
winning.
Well, no, they said actually hung jury. Don't believe they can get to acquittal, but they think they can get to a hung jury. So hung jury means that there's going to be some they are in terms of their jury pool pretty well fucked. This is Manhattan, not even New York City. They don't even get the Trump people from Staten Island. They just have Manhattan. Manhattan is a borough of 1.6 million people. Only 85,000 people voted for Trump. So I feel like a little bit about what Trump has been doing is putting out an APB to every one of his fucking freaks, which is to show up. If he can get one, the future of this country may hang on whether or not one Trump freak can hide his freak self long enough to get on that jury and then just cross their arms and say, absolutely not guilty. I will never change my mind. Fuck you, libs.
And they show up wearing their totally impartial juror t-shirt from Crooked that you can get at Crooked.com. To see. How about that contextual mention, Jordan?
Jordan, who does a lovely job trying to market our fucking business.
Great job here.
That's what I'm saying. Gave him a shout out.
I mean, Melissa and I talk about this more, about the sort of the jury selection process, the questionnaire that you're allowed to give these jurors. But there's also all these jury consultants that are out there scouring the internet to see where you've donated, where you've registered, what you've said on social media. So, you know, odds are we'll be able to identify this kind of,
So I'm my
weaponized
feeling,
juror.
Yeah, my feeling. So you figure, there's a lot of people that don't vote in Manhattan. But if you care enough to try to fuck up the justice system on behalf of Trump, you probably voted in 2020. So you talk about 85,000. How many of those are true diehards? You say about a third, right? That's 28,000 people out of roughly 1.4 million adults in Manhattan. That's about 2% of the population. 2% of the population. Can they get a jury that's 98 out of 100, 10, 12 times? It's about two-thirds. That's about two-thirds, 75%.
Yeah, I just also think there's a large pool of people in Manhattan who didn't vote either for Trump or against Trump, and they could be radicalized by the propaganda right on site.
That's true. Also true.
Because it did happen to a lot of their fellow countrymen and women.
Yeah, it took a little time.
It did take a little time.
Although you don't really get the personal exposure. You really get to be there with the leader. You get to be there right there. You can smell the Kool-Aid.
He's nodding off. He's glaring at Maggie. You got the whole show.
The reporting about what the jurors have been experiencing, just coming in and being like, holy shit, it's Donald Trump.
Can you imagine?
That's so funny.
you show up for jury duty. You think you're going to get some fucking hit and run? No, you're on the Bragg Trump case. That rules.
If you have a lot of free time in your life.
I would say anything to get on that trial, knock on wood. Just kidding. I would tell the truth. I wouldn't talk about my liberal podcast. I would tell the truth.
Good thing you're a resident of LA. All right, let's talk about the broader political implications of the trial. There's a
general consensus that this isn't the most politically damaging of the four criminal cases against Trump, but that doesn't mean it won't have an effect on the race. Clearly, most Republican primary voters didn't have a problem supporting a candidate facing 88 felony counts. We were also reminded over the weekend that even Republican politicians who didn't support Trump in the primary are still willing to support a convicted felon in the general. Here's New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu talking to George Stephanopoulos over the weekend.
So just to sum up, you support him for president even if he's convicted in classified documents. You support him for president even though you believe he contributed to an insurrection. You support him for president even though you believe he's lying about the last election. You support him for president even if he's convicted in the Manhattan case. I just want to say the answer to that is yes, correct?
Yeah, me and 51% of America.
And if 51% of America jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge before a fucking barge hit it, would you do that?
Yeah, if he could, if it means that he could still have a future in Republican politics, even if he's dead.
Good for Stephanopoulos for the way he pressed him on that. Sununu looked completely humiliated and angry in that moment and just like morally bankrupt. This is a guy who a couple weeks ago was endorsing Nikki Haley and attacking Trump left and right. Now he's just bending the knee.
Honestly, like sometimes you think I have more respect for like the diehard Trumpers than people like Chris Sununu for doing that. I won't go on a long rant because I'm sure our friends at the Bulwark will do it. That was my first thought when I saw the Chris Sununu thing.
Let's stay in our lane. We're here to help
Sarah
Biden.
Tim, Sarah, and JVL are going to be very upset about this.
we're here to carry Biden's water.
Just pathetic. Just pathetic. Absolutely pathetic. So of course, 51% of American voters haven't indicated they're okay with a convicted felon as president. But what do you guys make of the polling on this whole situation so far?
I mean, I think we know that if people are informed about the charges, they think they're either very or somewhat serious. There was a poll where only 24% of respondents said they would vote for Trump if he's been convicted of a felony by a jury. So that would be a very bad outcome for him. But what we also know is that a lot of voters don't really know what happened, or at least don't have good information about what happened. Marquette Law School did a poll last year where they found that half of Republicans surveyed didn't believe that Trump took classified information from the White House to his home at Mar-a-Lago, which he did. It's a fact. Just objectively true.
Is mountains of evidence.
Not debatable. There's photos. There's pictures. Yeah. So, and then 18% of Republicans told The Economist in a YouGov poll that they had heard a lot about the hush money case. 39% said they had heard nothing at all about it. So again, there's just like a huge information deficit.
Yeah, and the Reuters poll that you cited originally, which I think it was like 23%, said that they wouldn't vote for him if he's convicted. Among those in that poll who said they would vote for Trump if the election was held today, so these are Trump voters in that poll, 13% said they would not vote for him if he was convicted of a felony by a jury before the election. So those voters would actually, they're saying... traditionally in polls, people are not great about predicting their own future behavior, but 13% switching would be a big deal.
Yeah, I also think having weeks and weeks of coverage of this case is just a way of also talking about all the cases. And one number that jumped out at me from the Reuters poll is that roughly 36% of Republicans say that it is risky for Trump to become president or receive classified briefings because he has the $500 million legal judgment against him. I thought it was like a big and surprising number. And like, I feel like more and more like, wait a second, hold on. He owes people money all over town. He's on trial. He's been convicted. Like, I do not trust that those numbers will carry, that all these Republicans will abandon Trump. But I do think it tells people that, like, for all the talk that like Steve Bannon's out there being like, this is why Trump is going to win. Being on trial is good for him. People do not like this. They don't like it. They don't like seeing their president on trial. They don't think it's a good thing. They don't buy any of that logic.
Yeah. And then the question is like, does it break through? YouGov did a poll today. 54% of Americans say they'll follow the case somewhat or very closely. 40% not very or not at all closely. Interestingly, only 38% said that they think he'll be found guilty. And that number is only 33% of independents. And so like 60-something percent of Democrats think he's going to be found guilty, and like very, very low among Republicans. So it would be a surprise. I do think... like everything else in this election, it's all on the margins, right? Yeah. Like, I think if he is found guilty, we should expect probably fewer votes to switch than we think. And if there's a hung jury and he's off and some people, oh, now he's going to win, I still think it'll be...
total exoneration.
I think it's going to be minimal in each direction.
Can I also make a hopeful pitch?
Sure.
That goes even further than that? It has been consistent in the polling that voters want the trial about his election interference to take place before the election. They want an answer. And I do think a little bit about this, including people expecting him to be found not guilty, is a little bit of like there's been so many years of noise about how terrible Trump is, the crimes, the chaos, the noise, the offensiveness, all of it. And I do think there's a little bit of people just want an answer. Like, he was convicted, we're done.
Yeah.
And like, I do think that that's the kind of thing that could be powerful. I don't know, but that's just a little candle I light.
Yeah. I think the biggest takeaway for people who listen to this show is just a reminder that we are the outliers. The people who obsessively follow the news and are mm-hmm. up on this stuff all day, every day, we are the outliers in this country. And a lot of people just have no idea what happened. And maybe they'll figure it out before the election. Maybe they won't.
Right. It's just a swirl of noise that will get louder over the next several months. But it's still, a lot of people are tuned out. And more people are tuned out, I think, than they were in 2020 and 2016.
No doubt.
Not just because we keep rerunning the same race, but because just the people are consuming less news. They're consuming it from different sources.
We're allowed to leave the house.
We're allowed to leave the house.
That helps.
Yeah.
And if you're hearing this in a jury room, just be fucking cool. Don't lie. Be ethical.
Turn it down.
Just yeah. be Delete fucking this. Cool.
Download Ben Shapiro.
Be cool. Chill out. You've got this.
You
like to
nothing.
Hear from all sides. You like to hear a lot of different kinds of opinions.
You've never heard
You're
of Substack.
Open. You're open. Never heard of slow boring.
You don't know who Norm Eisen is.
Yeah, you've never heard of Andrew Weissman. Wouldn't know him if you saw him. Rachel who? Maddow? Never, not familiar with the name.
The New York Times reports that President Biden and his campaign have taken a, quote, virtual vow of silence about the trial, but that his advisors say, quote, they hope the trial will amplify their argument that the former president is running chiefly to help himself, including to stay out of prison. So, do you think that message will reach people based on the coverage of this trial, or do you think that Democrats, if not Biden himself, will need to be out there talking about this trial? And I'm just talking about Democrats like us. We're just lowly podcasters.
We don't matter. Yeah, yeah.
I'm talking about your Biden surrogates that are on TV.
I think anyone named Biden or who gets a paycheck from someone named Biden cannot talk about this case. It's just the upside is not worth it. The downside is huge. But I do think, like, Democrats writ large, senators, members of Congress, we need to be talking about this. There's the big picture substance. I don't think it's like the lurid kind of sexual details. I don't think people care about that. I think it's what you were saying earlier, like the fact that this guy cares only about himself. He'll do and say anything to get elected. He'll break the law. He'll rip off donors. He'll stage a coup. There has to be a countervailing message to the Trump, this is a Biden, you know, setup that's rigged against me kind of message, or else I do think that will break through and it's what people will hear.
I think it's a very good point, and that, like, you can't just think that there will be the coverage of the trial and that's what voters will consume, because they're also going to consume the Trump and the Trump world spin on the trial, and you have to push back against that.
And most days of the trial itself will be boring, mundane, procedural stuff happening. That will be the straight news copy.
I agree that Biden obviously can't go out there and be like, here's what happened in court today, and neither should the campaign. I do think they've got to find a way to indirectly or obliquely mirror the message they want to come out of that trial. So Biden talking about, like, Donald Trump only cares about himself. He always thinks he's the victim. He thinks the rules shouldn't apply to him. He thinks he's above. Like, I would start weaving that in, because I think it's going to be very difficult to get coverage for, like, your random policy announcement while the trial's going on, unless you sort of indirectly kind of.
I think
get
you
stuff
can do
there.
That. I think you can also do it with, like, jokes.
Yes.
Like, I'm not paying attention to all that, whatever, because Joe Biden going up and saying,
I hear
being
Sleepy
like,
Don.
I'm not paying attention to that trial, but it's a mess there, huh? What's going on?
It's a snooze. Just ask Donald Trump.
That's good.
What if
someone? Hey, that's good. Get that to them.
What if at the debate, Biden walked over to his podium and put $20 on it and was like, "That's the hush."
Hey. That's pretty good. I was thinking, what about a rule of southern? What?
Why did I said hush.
I don't. It's getting more thicker southern accent. Tommy's doing.
Wadia. It's been in my head.
Jesus.
Oh God! Now you're Lindsey Graham or John Edwards. Who was that?
No, it did have a gay lilt to it too. The people in the South, there's some straight people.
You keep
there,
talking
Tommy.
About gag orders and hung juries. Oh, you know?
Your mind is open.
What is happening?
No gag on Tommy.
Tommy just said, no one's going to be interested in the sexual details. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, not this country. Yeah,
I'm talking about the justice system. Yeah.
I think the Americans are deeply interested in the prurient details of this. And that's what we should be focusing on.
Were you going to say something about it?
I can't remember what the question was.
I derailed it.
What were we talking about?
Oh, what Biden out there talking about this, or Democrats?
You. I think other Democrats should be talking about the rule of law. The other thing too is, like, you know, the victory of the Times Siena poll showing that Biden has, you know, ticked up almost to being caught up to Donald Trump. It is such a sad statement of, like, you know, our society. But regardless, it's like, what's going on? And, like, there is this way Biden is paying, you know, the polling shows that, like, basically people view the pandemic as, like, force majeure. They don't hold Trump accountable for it. They have a rosy memory of the economy. They don't remember how terrible Trump really was. They hold Biden accountable for a lot of it. But ironically, I do think one of the things Joe Biden is being held accountable for is the fact that he promised to bring the country together. And even though people in that poll consistently say that they prefer Biden over Trump in terms of unity and bringing the country together, I do think Biden oddly pays a price for the fact that he only fucking slowed Trump down. He laid him down for a bit, but our politics are still consumed by him. And there is a way in which right now I would like to see people talking about the fact that the only way we can move on past this divisive and terrible era is by finally defeating Trump again and being done with him forever one last time. Like, this is the chance to have the country finally move on from the chaos and noise of the Trump era. It's like one last chance to do that.
Until, you know, Biden wins and then Trump runs again.
I guess.
I also say, so like, old. I don't know if this was intentional. I hope it was intentional, but I don't know if it was. I do like that Biden is specifically focusing on a tax message this week, and that he's going to Scranton, and he's going to do the Scranton Joe versus Park Ave Trump, you know, and Biden's in Scranton fighting for you, and Trump's in Manhattan fighting for himself, and it's a perfect place to talk about how Donald Trump doesn't think the rules apply to him, and he wants to just help out his rich friends. Mm-hmm. It's of a piece of what's happening in Manhattan right now, and so I do like that that's going to be Biden's message for the week. He's going to be talking about the economy and specifically taxes in Scranton and elsewhere in Pennsylvania. But as you mentioned, Lovett, in the new polling with the Times, like, we see the challenge that Biden faces is made clear. The good news from that poll is that he's cut Trump's lead from 48 to 43 in the last poll to 47, 46 in this one. That is mostly driven by Biden, at least in this poll, winning back support from Black and Latino voters, probably older Black and Latino voters. But when the Times asked people how they remember Trump's presidency, nearly half said he left the country better off. That is 9 points better than how voters felt about Trump right before the 2020 election. A plurality, 42%, also remember the years that Trump was president as good years for America versus 33% who remember those years as bad for America. Only 25% said they remember the last 4 years under Biden as good for America. So one of the oldest cliches in politics is that elections are about the future. But how much do you think that the Biden campaign needs to do some work reminding voters about the past? Tommy?
I think that a lot of work. I mean, look, every president is viewed more favorably over time for some reason. I mean, even like George W. Bush, he went out with what, like an 11% approval rating after the Katrina and the surge. I mean, he was in the dregs. I was trying to find the numbers right now. But Bush is now viewed more fondly than he was at the time. So this is in some ways normal. But I do think there's going to be a ton of work required to remind people of all the things that you hated about the Trump era. It is very weird that Trump keeps tweeting things like, are you better off than you were today 4 years ago? And that day was like the worst day of the pandemic in record, you know? So I think Trump's making it a little easier and making him easier on Biden to make the case. But, you know, it's frustrating.
Yeah, it does seem like the election's going to turn on whether voters remember who was president in 2020. Which seems to be a problem. It's that 1 year. Yeah. Just Trump was president from 2016 to 2019, and then Biden took over during that pandemic and told us all to inject bleach, and then inflation happened and a million Americans died. That was it.
And Biden takes so much grief for the handling of the pandemic and you know, sort of by the anti-vaccine people when Trump employed Fauci and Trump was responsible for Operation Warp Speed. I mean, it's incredibly frustrating the way that people's memories are just broken on this topic.
Yeah, I really am amenable to the theory that, like, this is a country that was traumatized and never dealt with the trauma of the pandemic. I just really do believe that. Joe Biden said Joe Biden was the adult. You know, this was a country, we were in the pandemic. We dealt with 4 years of Trump's bullshit. It was terrible. And he said, I will get us out of this. And he did. And yet there's all this sort of hangover from it, including the fact that, like, prices, yes, the inflation is not as high, but prices went up and stayed up. And that is, like, a big thing he pays for. Like, how do you go back in time and get people to remember the past more accurately? I think that's harder than reminding people of what Trump did and what it means about what he would do. I think that's how you go from the past to the future. He put the judgments in place that overturned Roe. He will continue to come after abortion rights. He cut taxes for the rich. That is his biggest accomplishment as president, was cutting taxes for the rich. He has already promised to do that again. That is the kind of presidency he will have. And, like, I think that's the way I think you can start telling a story about his term. In a way that does kind of let you pitch forward towards the future.
I found the numbers. In 2018, there was a poll where 61% of voters had a favorable view of George Bush, which was double the 33% that he ended with.
Yeah. So there's a recency bias, right? That's just in not just in politics, in all things,
yeah,
right?
All things.
And in politics, also incumbents for the last couple decades have just taken a lot of shit, right? You're the incumbent, you're held responsible for everything, so you take a lot of shit. I do think it is tough to spend a lot of the campaign relitigating the past. I think that is not what voters love. But clearly, Biden has this challenge. I think you use Trump's current behavior to remind people of the past, since the good news is that guy doesn't change.
No.
So, like, everything he did in the past that people were annoyed about, you have to talk about it again. I do think you want to move away from the Trump said something offensive, isn't it awful kind of attack to Trump is going to do this, and we know he's going to do this because, remember, he did it when he was president, or wanted to do it when he was president. So you got to get away from sort of the, oh no, let's flip out, he said something offensive line of attack, to the, here's what he's going to do. All right. President Biden is also dealing with an expanding conflict in the Middle East. Over the weekend, Iran launched a drone and missile attack against Israel in retaliation for a strike on the Iranian embassy in Syria that killed several top Iranian generals. It was the first time Iran directly attacked Israel, though the U.S. helped Israel shoot down nearly all the drones and missiles. One young girl was seriously wounded and an airbase sustained minor damage. Iran said that's the end of the attack, and Biden reportedly told Netanyahu to, quote, take the win, and said the U.S. won't support additional attacks on Iran. But the Israelis are still saying they'll respond. Republicans in Congress are pushing Biden to respond as well, or at least support Israel in its response. And all of this looks like it's going to come to a head this week as Mike Johnson figures out what to do about funding for Israel and Ukraine. Tommy, Iran was widely expected to respond in some way. Mm-hmm. But what did you make of how they did it?
Yeah, so as you noted, I mean, this was Iran's response to Israel killing a bunch of top Iranian generals. Imagine sort of the equivalent of if another country took out the chairman of the Joint Chiefs or the CIA director, and they did it in one of our diplomatic facilities, which are considered foreign soil. So it took Iran about 2 weeks to respond. They telegraphed what they were doing, but I was blown away with how extensive the response was. So it was 100 ballistic missiles, 30 cruise missiles, and 150 drones. So that's like it's a pretty serious arsenal going at your country. Now, as you noted, 99% of them were shot down in various ways. A lot of those interdictions were made by Israeli missile defense systems like the Iron Dome, David Sling, the Arrow 3 system, all of which were funded by Barack Obama, by the way, for all the people who say he was like a sold
so
out.
David Sling, not a person?
David Sling is a missile defense
system. Okay, I read that. I was like, who's David Sling?
I think it's a biblical illusion.
I think it's cool. King David. It's
my friend Dave. But again, you hear all these right wingers say Obama sold out Israel. In fact, he funded missile defense systems that literally saved lives. And then you had U.S. fighter squadrons that shot down about 70 drones. There were U.S. destroyers and missile defense systems in Iraq shooting down these ballistic missiles. British fighters helped too. Remarkably, the Jordanians and the Saudis contributed to this coalition of taking out these Iranian missiles. So it was a hell of a display of like military might and technology and coordination. The one thing, though, that, you know, before people get too triumphant, is the Iranians telegraphed what they were doing. They literally briefed. The Wall Street Journal reported that Iran briefed a bunch of countries in the Gulf about their attack plan days in advance. Those mm-hmm. countries obviously told us. So everyone is ready for this one. The next one will be different.
So it doesn't seem like it's in anyone's interest, particularly Israel's, to respond with another attack that would escalate this war. Why do you think they seem to be going ahead with it anyway? Or do you think they're going to do something like Iran mm-hmm. did, which is to save face, they signal. Have to do something or to send a signal or what?
Well, so back in 2020, the U.S., Trump ordered the assassination of the head of the IRGC at the time, a guy named Qasem Soleimani. The Iranians responded. They shot about a dozen ballistic missiles at U.S. bases in the region. By sheer luck, no U.S. service members died, but 100 of them had traumatic brain injuries and were severely wounded. When that happened,
which Trump said, no big deal, it's just some headaches.
Yeah. Right. So at that moment, Trump, the Iranian sent a message to the U.S. saying, all right, we're done. And to his credit, actually, Trump decided not to further escalate. A very similar thing is happening here. The Iranians did this response over the weekend, and then they said, like, okay, we consider the matter done. So Israel could pocket this or move on, or they could decide that Iran firing missiles at their sovereign territory is intolerable and they have to do something to retaliate to show that there's a cost. The military term you hear all the time is deterrence. We need to restore deterrence. There's also politics. You know, like Netanyahu is trying to hold together a super right-wing coalition where you have a bunch of crazy people, frankly, who are demanding a hawkish response. There was a report that a bunch of senior Israeli leaders in the war cabinet wanted to respond to the Iranians while the missiles were still in the air before they landed or hit anything. So time will tell. I mean, you know, these guys, the Iran and Israel have been involved in like a low-grade proxy war for many, many years. This is just the most open it's been. So we'll see. I don't know.
It's Israel killed a bunch of their generals. That was the tit. I believe this is the tat.
Yeah.
Seems like they've done the tit for tat. Mm. It seems like, and listen, I'm no foreign policy expert, but that does seem I think they've completed a tit for tat. And it seems like everybody should chill the fuck out because of the completed tit for tat.
My fear is that Bibi Netanyahu has wanted the U.S. to fight a war on his behalf against Iran for a very long time. We heard about this all the time in 2009. You can imagine a scenario where he does something to escalate things and then we get drawn in to make it worse. I mean, Ronan Bergman is an incredibly well-sourced Israeli journalist. He talked to someone in the Israeli war cabinet meetings last weekend who said, quote, if the internal discussions among authorities are broadcast on the media, 4 million people would rush to Ben-Gurion airport to leave Israel. So basically, it was so hawkish that it would scare people out of the country. But hopefully, like, cooler heads will prevail.
Do you think that's why Biden and the Biden administration was so public about saying, like, we will not, him telling Netanyahu, we're not going to support you if you escalate further?
Yeah.
Just because, like, he knew that Netanyahu might want to draw us into a war against them?
Yeah. I mean, there were reports that the Israelis were about to respond, but Netanyahu was like, let me talk to Biden first. And Biden's like, no, take the win, stop. And that stopped things.
So Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House, apparently, will either hold a vote on the Senate bill that combines aid with Israel and Ukraine. And if he does that, it could trigger a motion to vacate from Large Marge.
Marjorie Taylor Greene, yeah. Congresswoman.
Or he could hold a vote on an Israel-only aid package. The White House has already said that they do not support that. There seems to be a lot more pressure, especially from Republicans, to support Israel in whatever it decides to do. But this is also happening just as more Democrats have come out in favor of conditioning aid to Israel over Gaza. And it seems like even the Biden administration has softened their position on that. So what do you think happens now? And like, how does Biden handle it? How should Biden handle it?
Look, Mike Johnson has been sending so many conflicting signals over the last, like, even couple of days, because he has been reassuring people, like, behind the scenes that he is going to do a Ukraine bill.
Yeah, he's telling donors he will.
But he's been dragging his feet now for weeks. Originally the idea is that you put them together so they both go. Separating them seems to, at this point, please no one and doesn't do anything to save his job. So I don't totally understand. I don't even understand what he's hoping to figure out, because it just seems like if he means what he says, which he has been persuaded that we have to do Ukraine aid, and it does seem like that. Remember that meeting where basically Biden, like, put it hard on him, how important it was to do this. It seems like that there has been a legitimate, like, he legitimately understands the importance of actually doing this because he thinks the country should support Ukraine. I don't know how he gets out of this without ending up with some kind of a motion to vacate. And if that is where he is ultimately going to end up, it seems like he would end up putting the combined bill together.
The interesting thing here, though, is you notice, I think Speaker Johnson did his little pilgrimage down to Mar-a-Lago last week. And they did a press event after he and Trump. And Trump really seemed to knock down any suggestion that there should be a motion to vacate or, you know, effort to oust him. So that did seem like a pretty public rebuke to MTG. I mean, I think broadly, though, like, I think what this horrible incident over the weekend shows is that the war in Gaza is growing and metastasizing and continues to be destabilizing 6 months into it. Remember, like, the Iranians, their proxy groups killed two U.S. service members in Jordan. The Houthi rebels are firing missiles into ships in the Red Sea, like, every day, basically. Hezbollah has tens of thousands of missiles aimed at Israel, and they have not gotten fully engaged in this war, and they could at any time, and that would be devastating. So what this tells me is we are working with an Israeli government that is not making smart strategic choices. They're making a lot of political choices. And I think the priority from the Biden White House needs to be getting a permanent ceasefire, securing the release of hostages. In the interim, could you imagine a scenario where you make sure the Israelis are fully stocked up on missile defense interceptors and defensive weapons? Absolutely. But are we really going to write a big blank check for a bunch of 2,000-pound bombs that are getting dropped on, you know, civilians in Gaza? I don't think that's a good idea. I think we need to de-escalate. No one wins a full-scale war between Iran and Israel. No one.
If Israel aid passes Congress, can the Biden administration still, like, condition that aid, like, based on what Israel does? Like, if Congress obviously appropriates the money, but then can the Biden administration still say, like, well, we have decided that this can go and this military aid can go and this can't?
I think they have an enormous amount of flexibility in terms of how they slow things down.
Got it. As we were talking, our friends at Punchbowl and other Hill reporters are reporting out of the GOP conference meeting. This is Mike Johnson's meeting with his caucus. Apparently, first of all, MTG said that the Trump standing by Johnson doesn't change her plan to oust him if he screws her.
Weird that logic didn't work with her.
Yeah. But they apparently, Jake Sherman says, House Republicans plan to try to pass four bills this week to send aid to Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan, according to four sources familiar with the plan. The fourth bill will include a ban on TikTok, a bill to sell seized Russian assets, a Lend-Lease Act for military aid, convertible loans for humanitarian relief, and other provisions. And the GOP leadership will try to move this plan under one rule.
Okay. That doesn't sound simpler.
It does not sound simpler. And then Hakeem Jeffries said, we're not going to come to any conclusion on process until we understand the substance, which seems
right. Seems like a
reasonable thing to say. This Monday afternoon,
Seems like that should always be the case. Certainly.
Yeah, one would hope, right? I mean, it does seem like the Senate bill is the easiest path here, but he doesn't know what he's doing. It seems like Mike Johnson doesn't know how he gets out of this, like what you're saying.
He doesn't know how to get out of it, and he's looking for some new, there's always been like this search for some way to like cut the Gordian knot, and it's just like, it isn't there. You're just gonna have to untie it and lose your job.
Yeah, you have one vote, pal.
Yeah. Apparently he also said in the meeting, Johnson said, Ukraine needs to stand on its own. So.
Okay. What does that mean, though? They were invaded. People are getting killed daily.
It's like, fucking... if we keep giving Ukraine aid, it'll never learn the self-sufficiency and go out there and get a job.
Right.
It's time for Ukraine to fly out of the nest. Ridiculous.
Unbelievable. All right. Before we go to break, a few quick housekeeping notes. Buy our book, Democracy or Else. If that sounds threatening, good. It was supposed to. We only have a few months left to try and stop the country from getting Donald Trump as president again. So we're done with subtlety. when were we not done with subtlety?
This is not the, we're not in the nuance business, are we?
No, I didn't think so. Anyway, pick up brand new Democracy or Else merch inspired by our book that you haven't even seen yet, but the merch is inspired by it. At the Crooked Store, wear it to remind you and everyone around you that this really is a make or break election. We were just kidding the other times. There is a range of tees, mugs, stickers, and totes. And as always, a portion of proceeds from every order will support Vote Save America, its partners, and other organizations. Shop the whole collection at crooked.com/store. Also, it's 2024, and as we said, we're facing another election with unprecedented stakes. If you're not sure how to make an impact, Vote Save America's anxiety relief program will route your recurring donations directly to grassroots orgs and down ballot candidates who need it most. We're not going to waste your money. With your help, they've already raised over $200,000 in recurring donations from more than 4,700 donors in March alone. Good job, VSA. Your donations have helped to support the work of the Black Male Initiative, Freedom Block Ohio, and Detroit Action, who are working to increase voter turnout and political power in Black communities, plus other organizations mobilizing for voter registration this year. Let's keep the momentum going. Head to VoteSaveAmerica.com to set up a recurring donation today. Paid for by Vote Save America. VoteSaveAmerica.com, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. When we come back, Tommy talks to Strict Scrutiny's Melissa Murray.
Mm.
Joining me now is the co-host of the best legal podcast in the world, some might say the universe, Strict Scrutiny, and the co-author of the book, The Trump Indictments, The Historic Charging Documents, with commentary. Melissa Murray, great to see you.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
It's always very fun to talk with you. So, wild day today, big legal news. We're talking on Monday. Donald Trump just spent the day in a courtroom in New York. Can you just remind us of the basics here? What's he on trial for doing? And what are the legal risks associated with Donnie sitting in a courtroom all day?
So, again, where to start, Tommy? The reason why I actually have to give you this information is because there are actually four different indictments against Donald Trump.
So
it could get confusing. This one is a state-level indictment brought by Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. And the theory of the case is that Donald Trump, before he became president, orchestrated what is essentially a conspiracy to falsify business records so that those business records could be used to hide hush money payments made to adult film star Stormy Daniels in order to prevent the public from learning about Donald Trump's alleged affair with Stormy Daniels on the eve of the 2016 election. So there are, I think, 34 different charges of falsifying business records, which ordinarily in New York State is a misdemeanor offense. But when it is done in furtherance of some other crime, here the idea is that it is in furtherance of state and federal and maybe state level tax violations, all of that leads to a felony charge. So this is being charged as a set of 34 different felonies, all related to the falsification of business records.
Oof, a lot of felonies. So the conventional wisdom you often hear about this case is that it's the weakest of the four cases that you just mentioned, though that doesn't mean it is a weak case on its own. I've heard you and your co-host push back hard on that notion. What do you think is the more accurate way to think about this specific case?
So I don't think it's fair to call this a weak case. I think that maybe to think about it in terms of the consequentialness of the other cases, yes, this may be less consequential in that it does not involve an effort to overthrow the results of a validly conducted election, nor does it involve an effort to allegedly sequester scads of classified intelligence documents in your own personal beach house on the Florida coast. So,
bathroom.
Yes, it's really a question of degree. Like when compared to those things, the, you know, impeding the peaceful transition of power, attempting to create a coup, attempting to keep these documents for yourself because they're your personal property. Yeah, this sounds like small potatoes. But I think if we were to think about this on its own, it actually does feel quite weighty. And if we think about it in tandem with those other three indictments, I think what it leads to is the sense that there's kind of a pattern, a practice of engaging in subterfuge, engaging, if these allegations are proven beyond a reasonable doubt, engaging in kind of fraudulent behavior in order to get what you want. And so, you know, I think one way that I might think of this case is kind of an amuse-bouche of election interference. I mean, it's not the kind of coup-adjacent behavior that we saw on January 6th, or what is alleged to have been coup-adjacent behavior on January 6th, but it is the effort to sequester information that could, at the margins, have changed the mind of the average voter who was kind of on the fence, not sure what to think about Donald Trump. I think that is especially the case in light of the Access Hollywood tape that came out, you know, as a true October surprise in October of 2016. If you were someone on the fence and that Access Hollywood tape gave you pause, learning about the fact that Donald Trump had also allegedly had these extramarital affairs with these other women and had paid off the National Enquirer to catch and kill these stories, that might have changed your mind about whether or not he was the right person to occupy the Oval Office. And so I think if you think about this case in that lens, then it's a really important case. It kind of goes to who is this person who occupied the office of the president, who was allegedly falsifying business records from the Oval Office, signing these checks from the Oval Office, and who now seeks to be president once again.
Yeah, and look, we know that Donald Trump thought these stories were potentially electorally damaging because he paid $130,000 to suppress them. And also, he complains constantly about social media sites suppressing the Hunter Biden laptop story because that also came out right before the election. So clearly, there's a precedent here. Earlier today, so in the courtroom, the DA asked the judge in the case to order Trump to remove some social media posts where he was attacking witnesses and to fine him for those posts. If Trump keeps violating his gag order like that by talking shit about witnesses or you know, maybe even the judge's family, if the gag order gets expanded, what are the odds that he gets some sort of penalty, maybe a stiffer one, maybe jail time?
So I think most of the judges who have had to deal with Donald Trump thus far, and most of them have been in the context of those civil lawsuits, have really been loath to throw the real hammer at him, which is contempt of court, which is, you know, holding him criminally in contempt for his behavior with regard to these different witnesses. You know, Judge Kaplan certainly talked about this, but no one has ever really gone up there. Like, the most we've seen from Judge Engoron are significant fines. And I think part of that is because the narrative that Donald Trump is parroting is that he is the victim of persecution. These are selective prosecutions aimed at discrediting him, and everyone is in cahoots with Joe Biden to do this. And the judges are in cahoots, the prosecutors are in cahoots, everyone. And so I think most of the judges don't want to make a martyr of Donald Trump by really throwing the book at him. So I think they give him a really long leash, certainly a longer leash than any other defendant would likely get under similar circumstances. I mean, I can't imagine another criminal case where the defendant was publicly and on social media attacking the judge's family, attacking prosecutors, attacking potential jurors. I mean, essentially creating a climate of fear for anyone who might be impaneled as a juror, that they're going to be doxxed, that their information is going to be given over to these hordes of individuals who believe and follow Donald Trump. I mean, it's incredibly intimidating. I don't know any defendant who would have been allowed to get away with this to the extent that Donald Trump has. So, you know, to the extent Donald Trump likes to talk about how poorly he is being treated and how he's selectively being targeted, he's actually getting some of the doest of due process. I mean, like, that's Kate Shaw's own phrase, and I think it's right. He's getting away with quite a lot because I think most judges are really loath to make a martyr of him.
Yeah, never mind the fact that he actually gave some of the judges who could rule on his case their jobs. You know, that feels like,
well,
kind of,
I mean,
a point in your direction, too.
The Eileen Cannon situation is really a novel one, and we can sort of talk about the politics of that as well.
I want to ask you about that at the end. Trump also reportedly took a little tiger snooze today in court. How long of a nap do you have to take before it goes from misdemeanor to felony nap?
You know, listen, this is, he's an older gentleman, and like, I don't, you know, we all need a cat nap now and again. Court proceedings, at least in this sense, I mean, people think about Law and Order and like fiery orations at the jury box, but for the most part, it's a lot of anodyne stuff, like back and forth between the lawyers and the judge. It can get boring. I'm not going to fault him for falling asleep. Not sure it ever gets to a felony, but to the extent he's sort of tagged himself as the more vigorous candidate here, it did seem like he was on a couple of Unisoms during today's proceedings. I don't know.
We'll find out. Yeah, you're right. He's an old man. We should not begrudge him taking a little nap.
I mean, who among us hasn't like drifted off in a really boring? Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to fault him for that. But yeah, like, you know, maybe there's some melatonin going on. I don't know.
The New York Times reported that the jury selection process could take about 8 weeks, and then it's going to keep Trump in town for like 4 days a week during that period. Can you walk us through the jury selection process? What is that like? What should we expect?
So, jury selection, I mean, especially for a case like this that is so high profile, where I think most jurors, prospective jurors coming in off the streets, have some idea about what's going on. That's going to make this a little more difficult than your average, you know, criminal case where the circumstances are likely unknown to the prospective jurors. Everybody knows about this. And in order for Donald Trump to get a fair trial, everyone has to be satisfied that the jurors that have been impaneled, whether as actual jurors or as alternates, are the kinds of individuals who are willing to take all of the evidence with an open mind. They don't have preconceived views. And, you know, and that's hard because Donald Trump is a polarizing figure. You really have to be careful that you don't have individuals who are stealth jurors who want to be on the jury because they want to stick it to Donald Trump, or stealth jurors who want to be on the jury because they believe Donald Trump is being unfairly treated and, you know, they're there to be a kind of poison pill. So there's going to be a lot of discussion. The questionnaire form for the jurors, which, you know, the judge has worked on with the prosecution and the defense to sort of identify the kinds of questions they're going to ask these prospective jurors to determine whether they can truly be impartial. It's going to take a lot of time to go through that. They've already called around 96 prospective jurors and dismissed about half of them because people are just like, listen, I hate the guy, or listen, I love the guy, or just like, I know too much and I don't, you know, like, and then there are those jurors who have legitimate reasons that they cannot be on a jury. They have childcare, or, you know, they're going to be out of the country for something, or it's a true hardship. So, you know, there are all of those kinds of anodyne things that get people taken out of the pool for jury selection. Both the prosecution and the defense have opportunities to make selections and to throw jurors out, prospective jurors out. So there are a number of peremptory challenges that each side has. And these are situations where you can remove a juror from the pool for whatever reason, so long as the reason does not have to do with a protected category like race or gender or religion. But I don't like the look of that person. Peremptory challenge. You can get those gone. And then there are challenges for cause. And, like, you know, like, this person clearly dislikes Donald Trump. This person worked in the Biden administration, something like that. Those can be reasons to get rid of people. So this is kind of painstaking, laborious work, trying to sort of get at each person and sort of suss out where they're coming from, asking them these questions, following up with them, and trying to put together your panel. And again, you have two different sides trying to assemble a group of 12 and then a couple of alternates that meets their needs, but they all have to kind of agree that this is the panel. So, I mean, that's really difficult work, and I think it's going to take some time, especially in a case as well-known as this one.
And so the judge disallowed direct questions about party registration or who you support politically, but you can ask about news sources you consume and social media, et cetera.
That's true.
But could I, as a Trump lawyer, look, we all live online. We all, you know, if you register to be a Democrat in the state of New York, that's in a that's public somewhere. That's gettable information if you post on social
media. And they will have jury consultants like doing all kinds of work like this. I mean, I think there was, like, I think there was a John Grisham novel about this with jury consultants. I mean, it's a huge cottage industry where they're doing online research trying to figure out what aren't you telling us? Like, what don't we know about you? What can we find out? On and on and on. And so this happens all the time. So yes, you may not be required to divulge your party affiliation, but they can be online figuring out, okay, you've donated in the last four election cycles to Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand. I guess you're a Democrat, and maybe I don't want you on this jury.
Give you the boot. O.J. Simpson died last week, RIP to the juice. It reminded everyone millennial and older, really, what it was like when an entire nation obsessed over one trial. The O.J. trial was different in that they allowed cameras in the courtroom, so we were watching this literally all day, every day. And it was obviously lurid in many different and awful ways. But do you have a prediction about whether this case could sort of meet that level of attention compared to O.J.?
I mean, the overlay of race with O.J. was just so evident when that case was being litigated. And again, Los Angeles had erupted in flames just a few years earlier because of the Rodney King beating that was, again, televised. And, you know, I think people made a lot of connections between the fact of those officers in the Rodney King trial getting off and then, you know, O.J. Simpson being charged with murder. So the racial tensions of that case and the sort of surrounding political milieu, I think, were very, very thick. I don't know if that is really the situation here. I mean, there's a lot to this case, and I know Donald Trump has tried to paint himself as sort of akin to the average black defendant, but he really isn't. He's getting a lot of benefits that most defendants are not getting in the criminal justice system. That's not quite the same thing. I also think the judges are really different. Judge Lance Ito, who was the presiding judge in the O.J. Simpson trial, I think most people would say his case management style, his courtroom management style, was not quite as stringent as Judge Merchan's. And I think that's really important. You know, a lot of things can get out of hand when you don't have a judge who's in control of the courtroom. It seems that Judge Merchan is this is his courtroom and we're doing things his way. And there's not going to be a lot of judging from the prosecution or the defense in lieu of the judge taking control of the courtroom.
Yeah, we got a racist on trial, not race on trial. Do you see all these Gen Z kids doubting whether we millennials actually watched the verdict be delivered at school? I know I did. Gen Z.
I mean, so is it fair? Can I confess that I'm not in your bracket? I'm not a millennial.
You're just outside of it.
That's very flattering, Tommy. I think I'm well outside of it. I mean, I was in college when the O.J. Simpson trial was happening. And I remember we were let out of class at the University of Virginia, not necessarily the most, at the time, the most enlightened place about race, but we did get out of class to hear that verdict. And I mean, it really was electrifying. People crying, people jubilant, and, you know, surprising in many respects. The one thing I do remember about that moment was that was really the moment where Jeffrey Toobin kind of ascended into the cultural consciousness. Like, he was the one reporting on that case from Los Angeles. He later wrote what I think is one of the best legal books ever, like irrespective of what you might think about Jeffrey Toobin. But The Run of His Life is one of the best legal books I have ever read, with the exception of the Trump indictments, the historic charging documents, and commentary by Melissa Murray and Andrew Weissman.
That's exactly right. Look, there was a monoculture, kids, and we did all watch it. And I'm sick of questioning us on Twitter.
We didn't have TikTok. We didn't have Instagram. We could not. There were no alternate sources of entertainment. This was it.
Shit was wild. Last question for you.
One more thing. Do you remember where you were with the Bronco chase? Like, that to me is the most salient. And the people thereafter, like, how you knew, like, how did you know if someone was a good friend? Would you drive the Bronco for me? Would you be like AC? Like, that's how you knew if someone was a true friend.
I mean, like, 100 million people watched it.
It was outrageous.
It was like a Super Bowl, truly. Final question for you. So you mentioned this, alluded to it earlier at the top. The most obviously open and shut case, to me at least, seems to be the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case, given the law, given the evidence we've seen with our own eyes, given the clear obstruction. But Judge Aileen Cannon seems to be just a disaster in terms of both of making decisions in a timely manner and also maybe understanding relevant law. I mean, can you just give listeners a quick sense of how strangely that case is proceeding?
I think you've characterized it exactly right. This is the open and shut case. All that is required for a conviction is that you have the documents. You know you're not supposed to have them, and they're still in your possession. And there are people in federal penitentiary for having far less than what Donald Trump is alleged to have had at Mar-a-Lago, leaving aside the question of, like, the obstruction charges and the moving the stuff around and allegedly trying to destroy videotape that shows them moving the stuff around. This is a pretty open and shut case, which is why it's so surprising that it's moving so slowly and it seems to be getting just gummed up all the time. And, you know, I think it's fair to say part of that is Judge Aileen Cannon. She is a Trump appointee. She was appointed during Trump's administration. She doesn't have a lot of criminal trial experience. Most of the cases that she's had as a lawyer and as a judge have been civil matters. She's had a couple of criminal cases, but they've been pretty anodyne fare, like felon in possession of a gun, maybe deportation cases, things of that nature. This is not necessarily a difficult case, but it does involve some complicated questions regarding the nature of the evidence, because much of the evidence is going to be classified information. So you have to deal with an entirely different statute, the Classified Information Procedures Act, to deal with that. She doesn't have that experience. I think you could ask real questions about what the extent of her working knowledge is, how it reflects here. I mean, we've already seen that she has been rebuked by the 11th Circuit, which is the intermediate court of appeals that's above her, right below the Supreme Court, for failing to get the law right on the question of the special master, even before this came to her as a trial. So, you know, real questions here. I will just note the political valence of this. The reason why Aileen Cannon is the judge in that case is because there are two major vacancies on the Southern District of Florida, and Joe Biden hasn't been able to fill them because the two state senators in Florida are Marco Rubio and Rick Scott. They're Republicans. Mm-hmm. And in order to nominate and confirm a judge to those district court seats, the home state senators have to give their blue slips. Again, another one of these archaic Senate procedures that just gum up the works. And they have never given their blue slips to a nominee to the district court out of Florida. And so there are two vacancies here, which means that when this case went in the wheel to be assigned to a judge in the Southern District of Florida, there is a 1 in 3 chance they would get Judge Cannon. So those are pretty good odds if you're Donald Trump.
We got to get rid of this stupid blue slip process. It's ridiculous. It's also just unbelievable to me that there is an actual conversation happening about whether Judge Marchand is a fair and impartial judge in this case because of something his daughter does when Donald Trump literally gave Aileen Cannon her job in Florida. What are we doing here?
So again, I think there have been circumstances, like, I mean, presidents nominate federal judges. I think, you know, it is perhaps extraordinary, unprecedented for a president to then wind up in the courtroom of a judge that he nominated. But, you know, things happen. Like Bill Clinton was the subject of a civil lawsuit before a judge who, again, like these things happen all of the time. I think what's really interesting here is that she's had so many opportunities to get this case on the right track and to do this by the book. And, you know, it seems like she's making a lot of decisions that A, don't make sense or seem only to make sense in the context of keeping things in the way Donald Trump might want them as a criminal defendant.
Yeah, and maybe dragging this thing out for as long as possible.
Well, I mean, which is what Donald Trump as a criminal defendant is exactly what he wants.
Ugh, frustrating. Well, listen, if you want to understand more about all of these cases, you should absolutely read the Trump indictments, the historic charging documents with commentary by Melissa Murray. Also, if you want to know all about the Supreme Court, what it's up to in the legal culture surrounding it. Like, where the hell was Clarence Thomas today? Nobody knows. Listen to Strict Scrutiny. Truly one of my favorite shows. Just so smart and so fun and funny at the same time. So thank you for joining.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks to Melissa Murray. And before we go, look, we said earlier, Trump's going to be counter-programming this trial with all kinds of rallies and events on Wednesdays and on the weekends when he's off.
Yeah.
And we just wanted to play one example of the kind of soaring rhetoric and powerful messaging that's going to come from Donald Trump in some of these events. This was from over the weekend.
If he can stick to this message, we're screwed.
Yeah, let's hear it.
The Union was saved by the immortal heroes at Gettysburg. Gettysburg, what an unbelievable battle that was, the Battle of Gettysburg. What an unbelievable, I mean, it was so much and so interesting and so vicious and horrible and so beautiful in so many different ways. It represented such a big portion of the success of this country. Gettysburg, wow. I go to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania to look and to watch. And the statement of Robert E. Lee, who's no longer in favor, did you ever notice that? No longer in favor. Never fight uphill, me boys. Never fight uphill. They were fighting uphill. He said, wow, that was a big mistake. He lost his great general, and they were fighting. Never fight uphill, me boys. But it was too late.
How fucking high was he?
It's awesome.
Pickett's charge. You wouldn't catch me charging, boys.
It's also, by the way, just sort of
Gettysburg. Wow. Gettysburg. Wow. You don't.
Here's the thing. You don't do a... The Gettysburg Address is too good for you to riff your own version. That he's up there being like, Gettysburg's so vicious, so beautiful.
4 years and score.
Seven truths ago.
Let this be dedicated to...
It shall not perish so beautifully.
Whatever happened to Robert E. Lee? He's a great guy. Why does everyone not like him anymore? Hey, must have been those Manhattan judges.
Robert E. Lee, no longer certified fresh. What happened there? I thought people liked Robert E. Lee. Not anymore. Not anymore. Rotten tomatoes.
Just a horrible, horrible, disgusting world. Also beautiful, beautiful.
His wife, so much. Sarah Lee, great chef.
It was so much. It was so much.
So much. So beautiful. So vicious.
But it was so much.
Hey, Donald Trump, you can become president. You just got to tell us everything you know about the Gettysburg Address and the battle that took place there. Just walk us through every detail that you got.
I think the Biden folks should put that in an ad. Just to have that riff.
It would be very funny.
Those are the kind of ads. They're like, throw it on Fox News. Don't test them. They're off the wall. I don't know if they're going to move voters, but I don't know. You have a bunch of people seeing that. They're like, what? What? I don't want this guy being president.
Yeah, what did he take?
That's fucking weird. Anyway, that's what we got for today.
The world will little note.
Nor long remember.
What we say here. All right.
Bye, everyone. We'll have another episode for you on Wednesday. If you want to get ad-free episodes, exclusive content, and more, consider joining our Friends of the Pod subscription community at crooked.com/friends. And if you're already doom scrolling, don't forget to follow us at Pod Save America on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and more. Plus, if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review. Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. Our show is produced by Olivia Martinez and David Toledo. Our associate producers are Saul Rubin and Farah Safari. Kira Joaquim is our senior producer. Reed Cherlin is our executive producer. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Jordan Cantor is our sound engineer, with audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Writing support by Hallie Kiefer. Madeline Herringer is our head of news and programming. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Andy Taft is our executive assistant. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Haley Jones, Mia Kelman, David Tolles, Kirill Pelaviv, and Molly Lobel.